sign up a friend today. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, listener-sponsored radio for peace.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals it is Wednesday at 8 p.m. and time once again for So What's Your Story? We are proud to be the only program in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only here on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, and along with a team saturated in talent, Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Hank Rubicek, our engineer and media relations scout, Tatiana Gago, and of course, Floyd the Wonder Dog, who's here with us as always. Together, we bring you great storytellers, ordinary folks with extraordinary stories to tell, who take us on astonishing journeys through windows of their souls before bringing us safely and gently back to the present. Every year moves at a relentless clip, and every year we reflect on the kind of people we are. Are we kind? Are we compassionate? Are we giving? Do we act tolerant and open, or merely convince ourselves that we do? Have we truly become any wiser with each year that passes? Have we done what author D.B. Harrop expects from the human condition, that being to have a big enough heart to love unconditionally and a broad enough mind to embrace the difference to make each of us unique? In short, it's time to once again check our capacity to accept and support each other. I think I speak for most of us when I suggest that we try, but haven't yet reached the point of ultimate success in the way we accept. But it's time to get optimistic, and there's no better way to feel that beat than by telling stories of acceptance. What makes tonight's stories especially powerful is that they tout action, ways to accept and not just to talk about it or to think about it. Reverend Jonathan Page will anchor tonight's narratives, complete with the spirit and heart that comes with them. Augmenting his tales will be a few gems from past programs and a special story shared by our own Hank Rubicek. Reverend Page is the senior minister at the First Congregational Church of Houston, one of the most progressive churches that I know of. With a bachelor's degree from Harvard and a master's of divinity from Yale Divinity School, he has also published extensively and is now completing his second book, a novel focused on Christian faith and set in the Niger Delta. In reading about Jonathan, I was moved by this quote of his: "People are hungry for a church that rejects biblical literalism, affirms the compatibility of science and religions, welcomes the LGBT Christians, and has a passion for social justice." That's very much like the church I was raised in, particularly the social justice aspect. And I think, in my view, there's no better community to be a part of. So welcome to So What's Your Story, Jonathan Page.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's great to be here, and it's great to be hanging out with fellow progressives who might be listening online.
We have a few of those, not exclusively, but we do have a healthy progressive audience. It's a tough question, but give us your sense about the reason it becomes difficult for many to accept differences in others.
Well, I'll give you the Christian perspective anyway. For Christians, it's always the root of us not being able to accept others is sin. And I know that's a tough word for a lot of people to hear. More progressive Christians see sin as a question of separation. When we're separated from ourselves, separated from one another, separated from God, we tend to put people in boxes. And you see stories coming up in the Bible again and again that reference this, going back to the Tower of Babel and, you know, through the story of the Good Samaritan and others.
Seems like people are much more accepting of their own sins than they are those other people's sins.
Right. Especially when those other people are different by some arbitrary category, whatever it might be.
Right. Your first story deals with a topic some may or may not understand. It comes about when you find out something unexpected and surprising about someone you know. Would you share this story with us?
Sure, of course. So this story comes from back when I was working as a minister in Ames, Iowa. Ames is about 30 miles north of Des Moines and is where Iowa State University is located. When I was there, I remember sitting in my office one day and I was finishing up some work and got a phone call. Not an unusual circumstance. Got a phone call and picked it up, and it was a member of my board of deacons. For this story, we'll call him Ted just to protect his identity, but not that he's listening, but even if he were. And so Ted calls me up and says, "Hey, John, can you come over?" And at this point, I said, I could tell the worry in his voice, and so I got in my car, drove over to his house, and pulled up. And as I opened the door and walked in, I could see his face was lacking color, and he said, "The police have just been here." This is not something I was expecting. So we go into his living room and sit down, and he tells me that he had ordered a video online that was of young children who were naked, that had pictures of young children who were naked in them, and that it was something that had been caught at the post office, and the police had come and raided his house, took all of his computers and every other thing that might have images on it or other such things. And he then went in and opened up to me about his attraction to prepubescent, mostly boys. This is someone who was married to a woman, had a family, and as I said, very involved in the church. He was a Boy Scout leader, had been for many years. He was a professor at Iowa State University who had recently retired. And as I listened to him tell the story, there was this reaction building up inside of me. We're not really taught how to deal with situations like that. We know instinctively that a percentage of the population is, for whatever reason, attracted to prepubescent individuals, boys or girls. And we know the damage that can cause those individuals. And so we have all these rules set up to prevent that or to punish it. But what happens when you actually know and care for someone who struggles with that type of attraction? And after that, of course, the legal process started. Part of that involved me getting a lawyer, helping him to find a lawyer, and then having to write testimony on his behalf because he was looking for character references. And it was harsh to hear him talk about how he would ask people for character references and say why he needed them. And people, some people saying no, they wouldn't do that. I remember visiting him when he was in prison. It's always an interesting experience to visit someone in prison when you're a minister. You don't expect to go visit your church members in prison. At least I don't. And I remember, again, praying with him through this. And all of it, the entire time, of course, had to be a secret because none of this was out legally. And one of the problems was having to go home and not being able to tell anybody about it, not being able to share what was going on. Eventually, over the course of time, it did come out. When it came out in the papers. It was reported in the Iowa State papers. It was reported in the Des Moines Register, which is the major paper in Des Moines. And you know, one of the things I give the church a lot of credit for is that when it was reported, we had very calm, sober conversations about it among the leadership. We installed some, we already had safeguards in place to protect the kids in the church. And then we, you know, again, had a good conversation with him, and the church was quite welcoming to him. And that was one of these things that moved me. Here is a church that was living up to its values of accepting all people, including folks that society can be hard to accept. When you know people who've had to register as sex offenders, you can see how much it destroys their life. I mean, it prevents you from doing virtually anything in life. And you know, it's nice to be able to have a loving community that you can, that still accepts you for who you are, understands that all of us in one form or another are flawed individuals.
Wow. Was there a part of you that took a while to get to that point?
Very much so. When I first heard the story, it was one of those situations where I was like, in my head, I was like, okay, I know what Jesus wants me to do, and I know what God wants me to do, and I just have to try and get my heart to be in that place and move there and open up to it, because, hey, what if I'm in that position? What if, not that particular position, but let's say I'm a position of, you know, being in trouble for something. I would expect my pastor to be a pastor to me and to be able to pray with me regardless of what the situation was. So,
well, I think what got me about your story is, though I knew the general theme of it, as you're telling the story, my first thought was, oh, I didn't know it was that awful of a person. I thought it was only a kind of awful person. But, you know, we're not called to just be there for the semi-awful situation.
Yeah, and he had a situation where there were no accusations against him of any improper conduct or any improper sexual conduct with any minors, which was great, good for everyone involved. He also got very lucky. His situation, because of his age, his health, some very positive character references, and a great lawyer, he was able to avoid a prison sentence. Generally, for that type of thing, there's a mandatory 5-year prison sentence. So he was able to be on probation for 5 years, and I'm grateful he's now done with probation and is able to live life with, not quite so heavily restrained existence.
There are many parables built into your story. What is the essential lesson that you want us to take from it?
I mean, the basic lesson is a lesson that all of us, regardless of who we are, all of us have certain times in our life where we need to be accepted and loved, even if we've done something wrong. Where we all need someone in our life where we mess up. We could even mess up really severely, and someone's there to step up to help us.
And hopefully we all have the opportunity to be that person for someone.
Yeah. I mean, it just reminded me of another story from when I was younger, but I don't know if my brother wants me to tell that story.
Yeah, there are stories we got to get family clearance on. Your next story looks at a chance encounter that leads to your understanding, both understanding and healing. Would you share that story with us?
Yeah, sure. So this story starts way back when I was a college chaplain. So my first job at a seminary, I was a college chaplain at Harvard. And in addition to being a college chaplain, I was a residential advisor for 36 freshmen in a dorm. And, you know, kids, 18, 19-year-old kids are at a great point in life because not only are they away from home for the first time, but they're also able to question everything under the sun. And one of the students in the dorm, who was on the same floor as I was, let's call him Sean. Sean was the son of a Lutheran minister. And like a lot of preachers' kids, if there's one thing that Sean had no time for, it was religion. And so just his luck to be put in the dorm where the dorm head was a minister and a chaplain. So we would have debates that oftentimes raged late into the night about religion. And Sean, like most people who don't like Christianity, had read up on his Christopher Hitchens and his Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and all those folks. And so he would be spouting out this reason or that reason. And I would calmly, at least try to calmly respond to him. And we would oftentimes go for a couple hours arguing about the nature of God. And he said at one point, he said, you know, John, he said, I may not agree with you, but this is the first time I've heard arguments that actually might make sense, but you're still wrong. I'm like, okay, thank you, Sean. So after freshman year, he went his way and I continued on my way. And then I left Harvard and taught high school in a Christian high school and then ended up in Iowa. And after that, I was actually visiting New York randomly. And this truly was random. I mean, I haven't been in New York since then. And that was 4 years ago. So I was in New York and it just so happened that I ended up staying with a friend. And this friend worked out at the Harvard Club of New York. Now, I had never been in the Harvard Club of New York. But hey, if they had a gym and if I could get in for free and work out, I mean, sign me up. So went down with this buddy of mine, Rob, and we went into the Harvard Club, and we go up, and of course, on the second floor of the Harvard Club in New York is this beautiful library. And knowing me, it's like I immediately gravitate to the library. So I start looking through these books. And as I'm looking through these books, I realize there's someone else who's also in the library looking through books. And I turn around, and there's this guy, Sean, who I haven't seen since he was 19 years old. And we start talking, and he now lives in San Francisco, and he was in New York to do job recruiting for the company he worked for. And he had never been in the Harvard Club in New York either.
Wow.
So for both of us, neither of us had been there before. I doubt either one of us have been there since, and we both happened to be in the library at the same time. So we start chatting, and I'm like, oh, how are things going? And he's like, oh, things are good. And I said, well, you have any plans in New York? He said, well, I'm just here for a day. And I'm like, great. And I'm like, well, what are you doing tonight? And he said, well, I'd love to grab dinner with you, John, but I've got to go to an NA meeting first. And so I thought to myself, an NA meeting? So all of a sudden my mind starts racing, you know. So he's going to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting somewhere in Manhattan. And I had to go to a friend's 50th birthday party that evening. And, you know, I said, well, here's my number. If something comes up, you know, or if you still want to grab some food, you know, let me know. So I'm at this, you know, birthday party. And sure enough, after I'm there for maybe an hour or so, I get this buzz on my phone. And it's this student, Sean, he's like, yeah, hey, if we can get together, I'd love to catch up. So I'm in a situation where I have to leave this party and this friend who I never see to go meet this person. But I knew he had gone to an NA meeting. So we went out, we met, we sat down, and he told me this long story. This story of his time at Harvard that I had never known, where he, while he was in his fraternity, became deeply addicted to Xanax. That was his drug of choice. And he talked about what that was like. And he also talked about his journey back to God. He said, John, you'll find this funny, but this is, it's brought me back to faith. And he's like, I still remember those conversations that we had. So we talked. I was expecting to spend maybe 30 minutes talking. We ended up talking for well over an hour. By the time I made it back to the party, it was basically over. And I was a little bummed about that, but I was like, okay, it was great to catch up with this guy. And the next morning I wake up and I've got a text message on my phone. And it was this student. And he said, John, thanks for meeting with me. I just want to let you know you probably saved my life last night. And it was one of those texts you don't often get, but clearly he was in a lot worse place than he had seen. And he was thinking about making some really bad life choices that maybe were ones that would be hard to recover from. And it was just, it was one of those things where... I haven't seen him since then. I mean, this is, what are the chances?
How do you explain that?
I don't know.
I mean, for me, I call it the hand of God.
I mean, I would too. I mean, given my profession, I certainly would. This is the tricky Christian notion of providence. How do you deal with providence? And, you know, there's always those times in your life where you look back on life and you say, gosh, It seems as though there's a plan here. There seems as though something led us to this. And yet, in the midst of living life, oftentimes it can seem so random.
Well, it's also interesting to me, you know, that you were there for a big event, but something told you to walk away from it.
Yeah, it wasn't easy. Part of me was tempted to text this guy back and say, "Hey, can we catch up tomorrow?" I mean, again, I don't go to New York often, and my friend who was having his 50th birthday, I don't see very often. So, but yeah.
What's the lesson you'd like us to take from this story?
Well, I think it's a lesson that we get in our life in various times, which is you never know how important small interactions can be. I mean, just small. I mean, here's another story. I know I shouldn't be, you know, interjecting more stories, but this story actually fits in, and hopefully you don't mind, you know, squeezing it in. So this is a person in my congregation in Iowa told a story about his grandfather, who was a bank teller. And as a bank teller, he was sitting at the bank, and he was there, and he tells one story about how he greeted someone there at the bank and just said hi to him and asked him how he was doing. This guy that day was about to go rob that bank.
Oh, wow.
And he was so struck by someone actually asking him how he was doing that he left the bank, threw the gun away, and made a change in his life. And the guy who actually was nice to him at the time never found out about this story before he died.
Really?
It was just his grandson that had been told it.
Wow.
By a family member when he went back to that town. But even that small interaction that you might never know. You never know how big those chance interactions can change people's lives.
Score one for unexpected moments of kindness.
You never know.
It's so easy just to walk by each other and ignore each other, but you never do know. Well, my friends, this is Greg Audell with Tatiana Gago in the control room, and you are enjoying Stories of Acceptance with my guest teller, Reverend Jonathan Page, on So What's Your Story? On Houston's 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 for our friends in Livingston. Tatiana, can you tell our listeners what to expect when it comes to December storytelling in our great city?
Of course, Greg. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, which is located at 1500 Sunset. The Guild sponsored Telebration last Saturday, and it was a great spectacular event. The Guild sponsors all sorts of great events, so be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org for information about all the great stuff that they do. And while you're checking things out on the Guild's page, make sure to listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under Radio Program. There are well over 400 of them, so you better get started. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
So, and if you don't own a radio, that's not an excuse and no problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpfd.org and on Facebook Live. You can visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and share it with all of your friends. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave.
Please like us. We like you. Please like us.
We'll love you if you like us.
Absolutely.
So What's Your Story is also on YouTube. So come to think of it, we are all over the place.
You cannot escape us if you like a good story.
And remember our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy dazzling stories and get acquainted with Houston's storytelling community. The next one is going to be December 11th, and the theme is Instinct. Instinct tells me to get there and enjoy all of our growing community tellers.
I hope you do come, Tatiana. I will definitely be there. I've got a story ready to tell, so I will put my name on the hat and cross my fingers that it gets drawn. And if you've been listening to us for a while, I hope you come out and put your name in the hat. It's a really fun night. Thank you so much, Tatiana. Now, Hank, I know you're out there somewhere, even though I can't see you. Are you there?
I am indeed.
Excellent. Through the years, you've had the good fortune of hosting some stellar tellers, all of whom are community leaders. One was Rabbi Sam Karf. Tell us about the story that we are about to hear.
Well, first of all, you know, sometimes when we put together these shows, Greg, we never really know how things are going to fit so meticulously.
And amen.
Jonathan's reference to small interactions meaning that much, he has no idea how insightful that is, because that's what we're about to hear from Sam. You know, I'm honored to call Sam Karf my friend, a real friend. And I heard him deliver a sermon, in 2004, and it was on Messianic Moments. And to say that it made an indelible impression on me would be the proverbial understatement. And what this story is really, I think, one or two quick hitters, which are exactly what Jonathan was just referring to. Let's listen to these, Tatiana.
Ago, I was visiting New York City. It was early in the morning, and I needed to stretch my legs, so I decided to walk around the block a few times. As I was rounding the corner closest to our hotel, I saw a man sitting in a wheelchair at the corner. He wasn't selling anything. He wasn't asking for anything. He was drinking coffee and eating a donut that had been brought to him. He was poorly dressed. I didn't know anything about him, but the face fascinated me. The face just radiated goodness, as did his smile as I rounded the corner. The second time I encountered him in my rounding, he called out, "Number two." The third time, number three. And the fourth, which turned out to be the last time, number four. But for some reason, I couldn't go past him. I approached him. I took my gloves off. I lowered myself so that I would be even with his wheelchair. I extended my hand and said, "I'm Sam." And he responded, "Hi, I'm Jim." And I said, "Jim, I have the sense that you are a very special person." And at that point, he teared up, said, "Thanks, I needed that." That's all that we said, except, "God bless you, Jim." And he said, "God bless you, Sam."
Pretty amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a quick interaction. And this is the kind of stuff that made an incredible impression on me. So, Jonathan, when you were talking about these quick interactions, you know, there was one other story that he told, just a 30-second story, where he was in the emergency room once with his wife. And he was looking around, and nobody was talking with each other. They were all worried about their own families that they brought into this emergency room. And after about a half hour, he noticed that when a doctor came out to make an announcement about one of the patients, a total stranger turned to him and would say, "How's your wife?" And then somebody else said, "How's your son?" And everybody would start talking with each other. They didn't know each other. And then he said somebody got up and offered somebody else a cup of coffee, and then some change to make a call, and loaning somebody a cell phone to make a call. Suddenly, individuals who didn't even know each other's names shared this common denominator, the fear. You know, when he was on the show a number of years ago, after the program, he said to me, "You know, Hank, I really like what you do on this program, and you feel these issues really well. What would you say to being one of the symposium speakers at the next Yom Kippur services?" Well, I didn't want to tell Rabbi Karf that I never go to temple anymore. It's like saying no to God. So, of course, I lied, which I'm sure he knew. Said, "Of course I would do this, and of course I go to temple." And, you know, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. It was a 15-minute presentation, and I'm not going to bore our listeners with all of it because I want them to keep tuning in. But the premise of these series of stories that I told were about accepting the fears that fueled my family's lives after they were in the Holocaust or when they were survivors. You see, I was taught not to trust. And Jonathan could probably relate to this. There are people who were taught not to trust. The easiest thing is to tell people everybody hates you. Nobody likes you. And when you're 6 years old and you think that nobody likes you because your family is paranoid, you don't understand that. And I was angry with them. As a matter of fact, I even talked to my mother about it around 10 years ago and she understood. And that's where this segment that I'm about to share with you comes from. Hope that makes sense. I'm afraid that Rabbi Karf is under the impression that having a doctorate in communication will catapult me into a category I don't belong. I'm not a wordsmith, nor am I an interpersonal maestro. I know about communication, but it doesn't mean I do it well. Sometimes I feel like a cardiothoracic surgeon who smokes, completely aware of what I should do, but instead do everything wrong. Instead, I do what feels good and do what my impulse compels me to do. As someone who has studied communication as an art and a science, I can tell you that our spurts of reckless communication are never correct. Things we say are oftentimes inadvertent. We're sorry and we move on. But too many of us feel comfortable, even well-equipped, at having our lips drip of harsh words and menacing thoughts. I have the verbal skill to destroy anyone, and in the past have done so on more than a few occasions. But I've learned not to be mean. I like that about myself. It's better to be nice, or to paraphrase Rabbi Karf in one of his High Holy Day sermons delivered many years ago, to embrace your life by committing, or at least acknowledging, messianic moments. Those specks in time when maintaining the dignity of another eclipses your personal need to win. Then we could become human beings in the best possible sense of the word. I didn't learn to be a human being in graduate school, and don't you dare think that common sense teaches it either. I discovered it by conceding that my spirituality is my religion. That's a true revelation, because now I understand why I was always bothered by what so many write in their online dating profiles. I'm not religious. I'm spiritual. Is that admission supposed to impress us? I think those who say that are confused. I was. I went to Rabbi Carr for counsel years ago when I was going through difficult times. He suggested I come to services and become an active congregant. I alleged that I didn't really need the religious component because I was spiritual. And he told me that my religion was my spirituality, and I thought, what does he know? He's just a rabbi. Well, he was right. I needed to revisit my religion and only then achieve the magical byproduct called spirituality. With that in mind, please let me take you on a part of that journey. I promise to return you in plenty of time to break fast. I live with my grandparents, parents, and brother in a conservative Jewish home in Cleveland, Ohio. Three generations living under one roof wasn't terribly uncommon. My grandmother, Razel, ruled, literally. My mother tried to mother me, but was dwarfed at every turn by Grammy. My grandmother might have been the founder of Chelm, that mythical village populated, according to Jewish folklore, by fools. My grandmother was no fool, but she knew a fool when she saw one. Wisdom was peppered generously throughout her soul. If I complained, she would render some Chelm-like anecdote like, "Woman, one woman cries, her pearls are thin, the other cries, her barley is thin." Or somebody else's problem is easy to carry up the hill, your own is heavy down the hill. If I asked what's for dinner, I never got a straight answer. My grandmother would pontificate, "Your stomach has no windows, so it doesn't matter what you eat. Just fill it up." I was 7. I said, "Okay." Or if I asked for a new shirt, I was told to sit and then told the story about the little boy at the carnival. What does that have to do with a new shirt? It did. I just had to wait until the end of the story. 25 minutes later, welcome to my world in Cleveland. She was the consummate storyteller, and in fact is the titanic portion of the material that I use on my radio show. If we meet in some kind of afterlife, she'll expect residuals. She had a story for everything, and if she didn't have a story, she'd offer some kind of perplexing rhetorical remark that would boggle my mind. "Do you like my girlfriend?" I'd ask. "Well, I was at the post office last week, and I didn't see her picture on the wall." I'd ask again, "Do you like her, Grammy?" And she'd proclaim, "Well, I'm sure she didn't kill anymore." I went on. I got it. A simple "she's just okay" wasn't her style. She defined human expression. And some wonder if she had any influence on my becoming a communication professor. And she did. A lot more than anybody will ever know. Because she taught me to accept her own flaws and the kind of pressure that I was under every moment of every day for so many years. To do the right thing, to date the right girl, to do things that, frankly, I didn't want to do. And they were wrong most of the time, my family were. But I understand them because I love them. And acceptance is everything. It solidifies the human condition.
Oh, that is beautiful, Hank. I would love to have known your grandmother.
Thank you. Yeah, she was pretty great.
And I do love, one of the beautiful things I love about storytelling, particularly as we approach the holidays, is storytelling is a way to keep these family members and friends alive for the next generation. You know, and though I suspect your grandmother's been gone a while, she is in a way with us tonight.
She's sitting right next to you, Greg.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. That wouldn't surprise me.
Saying, "Speak clearly."
Yeah, that's what she's doing. I'm sure she'd have more to say to me than that.
Yeah, drink more tea. She'd have that too.
Stretching the boundaries of the human heart is a prerequisite for acceptance. And as of tonight's stories demonstrate, it's probably the best exercise there is for both our hearts and our spirit. Jonathan, your next story has a humorous topspin, but with the same level of acceptance attached to it. Please tell us.
Sure. This story, actually, to be honest, I got to make a confession. I am a religious person, so I should confess. The story,
really?
This story is actually a story that was told to me by a good friend, actually a friend I had a chance to see over Thanksgiving. And it's one that always sticks in my mind because I could just, you know, picture it in my head so well. So this friend of mine, Dawson, before he took his position now in Florida as a minister, was one of the ministers on the staff of Cathedral of Hope in Dallas. Now, Cathedral of Hope in Dallas is the largest LGBT church in the world. And at the time when Dawson was working there, there were several thousand members, several thousand gays and lesbians who were in the congregation. So if you think your church, if you're a listener and you have a church, you think your church has drama, I can assure you the drama in that church was, at the time, quite intense, at least according to some of the stories. Well, Dawson talked about how one time he was, it was an Easter morning, and he was there as the executive minister on the front dais with the senior minister, and they're getting ready for the big Easter service, and one of the deacons comes up and whispers in his ear, says, "Pastor, we have a situation in the narthex." So there's this like dead silence of like, oh, like how serious of a situation? Well, you should come out here. So as they're getting ready, like here's Dawson, who very liturgically stands. You know, this is the whole thing as a minister. If you do it slowly and deliberately, it looks as though it's planned. So Dawson stands up and says, leans over to his boss and says, "I have to take care of a situation in the narthex." So he goes out there and he walks out, and there he sees this drag queen, a drag queen well known in the community, a drag queen all dressed up in a wedding gown. And so Dawson's like, "Well, how are you doing today?" And she was like, "Well, you know what? I'm done with men, and I'm here to marry Jesus." And so, and so, so there she was in her wedding gown. And I think, so Dawson said they're trying to figure out what to do. Now, this church, because the church is so large and prominent, had a, you know, had a security detail out there because they'd had a lot of threats against the church, as an all LGBT church. And so the security was preventing her from going in because she was making quite a scene. And so Dawson sat down with her and said, "Listen, we're more than happy to have you here. We're glad that you want to dedicate your life to Jesus. We're here to support that. We just can't have you making a big disturbance in the middle of Easter Sunday. Would you mind being around? You know, you come in the service and then afterwards we can talk." And so she said, "Oh yes. Oh yes, Pastor. Oh yes." And so she went in there, and like everyone else, even though she was dressed in a wedding dress, and this service was live telecast, there she was coming in for communion like everyone else and being able to celebrate the resurrection along with her fellow churchgoers. But it's one of these stories that I love because it shows, it's a story of radical acceptance in a church where so many churches unfortunately struggle to accept LGBT people. We see that in Houston, we see it in other parts of the country. And Cathedral of Hope not only accepts people when they're in their church garb or what you would expect people to be in for church, but for all people as they are in that moment and where they are in their spiritual journey, even if you're done with men and ready to marry Jesus.
Wow. Well, one thing I love about that is really LGBT isn't the big issue there. It's that, you know, everyone's an oddball at some time in their life, and oddballs need love just like everybody else, love and acceptance.
Yeah, and I get, again, I mean, the compelling message of Jesus for me, or one of the many compelling lessons of Jesus, Jesus was someone who violated all the norms of his society at the time. I mean, here is someone who shared table fellowship with those who were outcasts. He shared table fellowship with those who were prostitutes, those who were tax collectors, and those who fell into the general rubric of sinners. And that, of course, encompasses quite a few of us. And that's what he was doing, even when people were criticizing him, of saying, "Jesus, why are you doing this?" He was trying to live into what he saw as being the image of the kingdom of God, that in God's kingdom, everyone is accepted. Everyone has a place at the table, and God loves all people.
So why is it, in your experience, why is it so easy for millions and millions of people to understand that lesson that is in the Bible, and it is so difficult to put into practice in their daily life?
Again, I mean, people, it comes down to, in my mind, a number of things, one of which is, so people like to have rules. We like to live by rules. You like to say that there are certain rules and certain ways of doing things. And when people violate those norms, those rules that are in your head, it can be tough to get over it. It can be something small, or it can be something bigger. I mean, it could be that type of person who parks intentionally across two parking spaces, which always drives me bonkers because they don't want their car to get dinged on the side. And it's like, hey, none of us want to get our car dinged, but we also want to find a place to park. So can you please respect the rest of us? You know, but so you see someone. I mean, but when people violate various norms, it bothers people, and they like to put people in boxes and judge them.
I think in people's minds they think, well, Jesus wasn't talking about that idiot.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, there's.
I mean, he had his own people, but he never met this person.
Right.
He never saw that group.
I know. He didn't do quite that many things. Yeah.
Well, listeners might think that your story was unusual, a one of a kind, but no, not on this show. Rabbi Laura Sheinkoff, a good friend of this program, told a story about a wedding she officiated with a similar humorous theme. Tatiana, will you play Laura's story from March 13th, 2014?
Several years back, I was asked by an acquaintance who's a wedding planner to give an opening prayer for a meeting of an organization that raises money for worthy causes, and it's an organization of drag queens. It's a national organization. And they asked if I could come and do the opening benediction for their meeting because he was being installed on the board. And I have to tell you, under normal circumstances, coming from, let's see, you know, I grew up on Cape Cod, I went to school in New York, I'm obviously very well connected in the arts and the world. Drag queens are, you know, it's not a big deal to me. So I would have normally said yes, but I had just recently separated from my husband and it wasn't a good time. And I decided to step away from being a pulpit rabbi a few years before, and I really didn't have a place in the community, and I was feeling rather bad about myself, but I said okay. And then he said, yeah, we figured you wouldn't have anything going on because it's Valentine's Day. That kind of hurt, but I pretended that he meant because it is a Saint Valentine, but I think he was meaning something about me being single. So we just overlooked that, and I went down, and of course I couldn't even find him because everyone was in drag. And I was exceptionally unexceptional in that crowd, very small. And I understand how to perform, so I tried to conceal it, but it was a really tough time for me. And I felt somehow shut out of my own community, even though that was in my head, I think. So all that kept going through my head was that line from Angels in America where he says, you know, things are bad when even drag is a drag. And that's kind of how I felt. So I got down there, and they called me up to give my benediction. It's a crowded bar. Everyone's in drag, very noisy. When you speak at a synagogue or a church, there's always someone clanking around in the kitchen or people talking in the back. The microphone pops, right? Not these guys. They had the microphone set up to me beautifully, modulated already for my voice, and a pink lighting make me look better. And I got up there and opened my mouth, and it was like the seas parted. Like, you could have heard a pin drop. And I don't even remember exactly what I said. I actually talked about the reason I named this story, It's Where You Stand, is because I actually referenced a part of Genesis where Adam has eaten an apple, right? And he suddenly is ashamed, and he goes hiding from God, which is strange, right? And God says, Adam, where are you? Which is also strange because it's one garden, one man. Why would God not be able to find this person, right? Yeah. And so the rabbis say he really wasn't asking, where are you? He was asking, who are you? And that's why eventually what Adam had to say was, Hineni, here I am. Hineni is not the same in Hebrew as saying, Ani po, I'm just here. It's an existential, a deeply felt acknowledgement of where you are in life and why that makes you who you are. And so I said something like that. And I mean, I just remember seeing tears in the eyes of I remember seeing the false eyelashes, being very impressed with those and how moved they were. And it was an incredibly important moment for me because it made me realize that, first of all, it took me out of myself. It also showed me, again, the power of sharing yourself and your story, even if I wasn't doing it explicitly, but putting myself out there, right? That is how we expand in the world. It is not by contracting. And And I felt that that was a tremendous gift to me. I go down there as much as possible because they know how to raise money, too. They're very entertaining. It was like a more valuable religious experience than almost anything I had done up until that point.
Oh, wow. What a great story. I hope Laura's listening to it. Thank you for sharing that with us, Hank, and thank you, Laura. I mean, it's all really about acceptance, isn't it? I'm Greg Audell, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston with my guest teller, Reverend Jonathan Page. Now, my friends, I want to take just a moment to recognize the passing of a legend. Ray Hill, KPFT pioneer, civil rights leader, victorious Supreme Court plaintiff, champion of the underdog, whether they be in prison, part of the LGBT community, or living on the street. Ray had no money that I know of, but he had passion and determination enough to fuel any number of movements. Of all the lessons one can learn from Ray's life, the most important to me is that if you choose to, you can make a huge difference to others. It doesn't take money. It takes determination. I believe Ray's last public appearance was on behalf of an organization I'm very involved with. New Beginnings Houston provides housing for our neediest brothers and sisters in the Houston area, whether they're recently coming out of prison, someone living on the street. My friend Joe Donaldson will find a house for them and a roof for them. At Houston's City Council meeting recently, in my opinion, they've been working to close shelters such as ours that provide housing for the homeless. And when Ray spoke, the mayor, the city council, and audience all greeted him, applauded him, but most importantly, they listened to him because of his lifetime of service and involvement. It earned him that respect. I pledge to do my very best to follow Ray's example, and I hope a whole lot of others do as well. In that way, Ray will live on for generations to come and touch people who haven't even been born yet. I want to thank Ray for his work at the station, his work for the underdog, and the example he gave to each one of us to follow through. And if you don't know about Ray, just do a little Googling and watch him on YouTube. There's a lot of documentaries being made about him right now and a couple of really good ones in the past that you can watch on Channel 38.9 Joe TV. And while we're talking about KPFT, it is the Christmas season, and I want you to know that we have a KPFT Christmas ornament that is shatterproof, and it features our limited edition KPFT logo on two sides, not just one, but two sides. The ornament is also made here in the good old USA and comes packaged in a nice gift box for a donation of only $30. You can log on to kpft.org and purchase that ornament. And as always, if you wish to make a bigger donation, please check So What's Your Story as the program you would like to support. Next week, Warren Holloman will host Stage's theater manager Ted Swinley. Then Hank will host some of our absolute favorite guests, students from Meyerland Middle School for the Performing Arts. I'm telling you, these kids not only have great stories, but they haven't been taught to be shy or afraid. I mean, they are some of the boldest storytellers that we have on. We always look forward to it. Now, Hank, you have a little final ditty for us, don't you?
I do. Thank you, Greg. First of all, though, beautiful words about Ray. He really was the heart and soul of Pacifica Radio. He really was. And, you know, as far as these kids, they're a riot, these kids from it's the old Johnson Middle School, the Meyerland School for Performing Arts. And they're a riot. They're always a nervous wreck when they come in here. They are nervous. Their parents are here. And they come into the studio. They put their headphones on. And then they look at each other and they go, "This is so cool. This is so great." And then I have to calm them down, get them ready to tell their stories. They are just the most fabulous bundles of energy. We were playing a Laura story. It occurred to me that when she was on the show, she was on twice as a guest. And one time, I just can't remember her friend's name. She was an Episcopalian minister. And we had a call in that night, and somebody called in and asked her friend, the minister, is it true that Jesus will always get us out of trouble? Okay, that was the question. And Laura's friend said to this young man, well, I guess you could look at it that way, but there are times you can't really count on Jesus to get you out of trouble. And a young man said, what do you mean? And Laura's friend said, well, for example, there was a young man who asked his father for a car. And his father said, well, if you get a haircut, I'll get you a car. And the young man said, well, I have long hair like Jesus. I mean, you know, what's wrong with that? And the father said, yes, and he walked everywhere. So I just thought I'd throw that one in there. Okay, good. It's not the little ditty, but I couldn't resist. You know, I have a short folk tale. Folk tales are marvelous. Last week we had some great folklorists on, and it got me thinking a little bit about this notion of acceptance. And once upon a time, there was a king in a country who was on a tour with his ministers, including his royal security and others. He was taking a rest under the shade of the mango tree and the mango garden with his team when suddenly a stone hit him directly on the forehead. Immediately, he started bleeding. Well, the king had no idea who threw the stone at him, but he did know that he was experiencing an intolerable pain. The security officers left right away to find the person who threw the stone at the king, and after searching, they found only one old lady there, and they asked if she had thrown any stones recently. She replied, well, I threw a stone at the tree. They asked her, well, did you throw any stone at the king? And the woman's face showed how terrified she was, so the guard forcefully told her that she'd be punished, and the woman was arrested and presented before the king. She trembled with immense fear and prayed that they would not kill her. After seeing the blood flow down the king's face, she became more upset and felt hopeless. What will happen to me? She thought. The king very calmly asked her, did you throw the stone at me? And she replied, Your Majesty, I threw the stone at the tree. Why? The king asked. Well, she replied, weeping, Your Majesty, my child has been starving for 2 days. I was collecting food for him, but couldn't find any. I hoped that when I threw the stone at the tree, fruit would fall so that I could feed my son. Your Majesty, by mistake, the stone hit your forehead, and that is my unknowing mistake. The woman bowed down before the king, begging pardon for her mistake. The king was kind-hearted and understood the situation. He forgave her mistake and ordered his security personnel not to punish her in any way. Instead of punishment, he said to give her money, food, and return her safely to her home. It was about generosity of time and heart, forgiveness and acceptance.
Wow, another beautiful story. You guys are giving me a lot to think about tonight.
About that?
Yeah.
Imagine that. We actually think after the show. I'm not sure we've ever done that.
We try. we try.
We drink after the show, but we don't think after the show.
Oh, I didn't think we were supposed to tell that.
Yeah, the word rhymes. We have to kind of get them in order right now.
Well, thank you, Hank. That was wonderful. And let me make one correction. Ted Swinley is not actually the manager of Stages Theater. He is the founder and founding artistic director. And he is also the author of the huge hit musical, Always Patsy Cline. So it's going to be great to hear Warren visit with him next week. I'm looking forward to it. Jonathan, I don't know if this is a personal or professional question for you, but tell us your wish for the holiday season.
I will say something professional for a second, and that is I encourage people, again, it's so easy to get caught up in the materialism of the season and the gifts and such. I actually encourage people, if you haven't done it already, whether you're a churchgoer or not, actually read the stories in Matthew and Luke about the birth of Jesus. And when you read the story in Matthew, for instance, you see a story of a family that has to flee violence in some sort of terrible dictator in Israel, and they end up seeking asylum in Egypt. We obviously have people who are trying to seek asylum on our own border, and it'd be nice if Christians could actually see Jesus in those people, rather than demonizing them and seeing them as the other, seeing them as Jesus in the Holy Family. When you read the story of Luke, the people who bring the great news to to the world, our shepherds, who are the lowest of the lows. I mean, they were the below minimum wage employees who are the ones that God chose to actually be honored to see this message. And the Gospel of Luke again and again goes out of its way to talk about the importance of lifting up those who are downtrodden, not just in terms of charity, but in terms of justice and changing the way things are.
I think that is a wonderful homework assignment. Whatever your belief or non-belief, there's still much to be learned from that story. You know, I will just say one thing that bothers me about this constant referral to the caravan is it's just kind of this mass of people, like the homeless. You don't see them as individual souls, you know, our fellow brothers and sisters in a traumatic situation. It's just easier to name a group, and we don't have to think about them as real people anymore. Whatever your feelings on any subject, I just think it's more important to realize these are real people. Every bit as important as all the people that you love. You know, I'd like to actually take one moment of a personal exception here and welcome our newest listener, our newest storyteller, who has, I don't think she has too many stories to tell, but she's going to have many, many. Ava Bartley entered this world on the 18th of the month and joined my family and has wonderful parents, Megan and Joe, who I think are going to give her a wonderful life full of stories. And who knows, maybe 10 or 20 years down the road, we'll have her right on this program. But I'm very happy she's here. Tatiana, what's on your wish list for Christmas?
Well, I'm not really a materialistic person, believe it or not.
Wait a minute. How about that one material item you showed me just before the show?
Okay, the camera, that was a beautiful gift.
Who gave it to you?
It was my boyfriend.
Aww.
No, but, you know, really, I just would like to just spend time with my family and relax for that day and just, you know, cherish the moments that I have with them.
I think that's maybe one of the wisest things I've ever heard you say, Tatiana.
Thank you.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. Jonathan, who was the storyteller in your home when you were growing up?
Oh, definitely my aunt Peace. She could then and still can tell a story that has everyone transfixed and in stitches. If you ever have a chance to hear her tell a story, you should. It's always entertaining.
I'm telling you, I wish everyone would think a little bit less about the gifts they're going to buy or, you know, the dish they need to prepare, and think a little more about the stories you want to share. You know, that's my favorite part of the holidays with friends or family. You know, it's just the laughter, whether the story is serious or I don't know. It's what I enjoy most about the holiday. Jonathan, I want to thank you for your inspirational narratives. Your stories were poignant examples of how acceptance is laced with tolerance, love, and grace. And we would absolutely love to have you back. Merry Christmas to you. And a wonderful New Year, my friend. And a very happy Hanukkah to our friends in the Jewish community. Don't eat too many latkes, though I don't know how many are too many because I've never reached that number yet. Don't you dare move, my friends, because Flash Gordon Parks is up next. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? Treasure what you hear. And don't be afraid to share your own stories. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.